At the legislature today, Senate Majority Leader John Unger asks his legislative colleagues to pass a resolution he hopes will help restore the public trust in government and the water. And the Senate turns its attention to what was one of the critical issues at this session, making some cold medicine available by prescription only. This is the legislature today. I'm Beth Voorhees. The day after the House's joint public hearing on Senate Bill 373, delegates began the process of incorporating suggestions to create what they feel will be the best bill to protect West Virginia's water supply. As Aaron Payne reports, the House also addressed the concerns of those who felt that the absence of some delegates last night was a sign of apathy.
During the floor session, Delegate Nancy Guthrie took the time to thank her colleagues that were in attendance for last night's public hearing on Senate Bill 373.
Thank you for all of you who sat through the public hearing last night on the water crisis that we've endured in nine counties. I appreciate it.
However, last night, some felt that there were too many empty chairs.
I am extremely disappointed to look around and see all the empty chairs here. Where is everybody? The delegates that are supposed to be there.
The moderator for last night's hearing, Delegate Don Perdue, says the turnout from his fellow delegates was satisfactory.
I want to point out that that was a hearing before the three committees of the House, which would be, if you had everybody, would have 63 members. Last night, I counted very late, we still had 33. So there was at least half of that delegation who could have been here that had stayed till the end.
Now with the public's suggestions, delegates will now dive into the details of the bill through three committee meetings. As this process begins, several rose to encourage their colleagues to do what they feel is best for the people of West Virginia in regard to future regulations.
For the sake of the kids, and there were a lot of them here today, for the sake of your communities, take a real hard look at what people are expecting us to put in these bills. Take a look at the recommendations that have been made by some of the experts. I want to be able to trust my water. I want to be able to trust my water company. And so I think that's not a whole lot to ask.
I'm tired of giving in to not fighting for the things that we know are right. I'm tired of having to advocate whether I want clean water or whether I support industry. Those two things should never come into the same conversation. The reality is that it is our responsibility as West Virginia citizens to demand pure water.
Yesterday afternoon, just before the public hearing, the Health and Human Resources Committee heard from West Virginia American Water Company President Jeff McIntyre and Dr. Raul Gupta from the Kanawha-Charleston Health Department. But it was the bill that was considered before their appearance that Delegate Patrick Lane brought up today. House Bill 4307 would allow elementary schools or parents of students at the school to serve sweets at the school once a year. Under current code, sweets brought in by parents must be made using an approved recipe at the school, an approved prepackaged treat, or be only for their child. The current regulations are based on fears of children's individual food allergies. Delegate Lane hoped that in the future, issues such as the chemical leak would take precedence over these kinds of issues.
Mr. Speaker, I'm asking that we get rid of the nonsense, that we get rid of the rules upon rules upon rules upon rules upon rules on cupcakes and barbers and every other nonsense rule that comes through here. Let's pass a moratorium on rulemaking for garbage so that we have time and energy and effort and resources devoted to protecting the water that our children drink when they wash down that cupcake.
In regards to the water protection bill, Delegate Perdue says that his committee will need more information from agencies scheduled to testify to them in their next meeting. Then the focus will turn on Senate Bill 373 itself.
Once we're able to get all of those folks before us and assimilate that information, then we'll get into the business of looking at the bill we have and see how it may be if it has to be, if it may be tweaked in ways that I think the public might find more appealing, or in effect, we don't know. We really need to get all that information in front of us before we can make a true determination.
For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Aaron Payne in the House.
After two public hearings on water in Charleston last night, the one in the House chamber and another at a local church, senators are now discussing ways to regain the trust of not just the residents of Charleston, but the entire state.
Senate Majority Leader John Unger stood on the floor today to share survey results gathered by the Kanawha Charleston Health Department. Dr. Rahul Gupta, the department's director, says that the 2,000 surveys returned from the nine-county area, only 1% of respondents say they're using the water. Unger says those results show that the public no longer trusts the water supply and no longer trusts their government.
We truly have a situation of breach of trust, and doesn't look like it's going to get any better. Matter of fact, it's not only the breach of trust here in this valley, but there's a breach of trust that's happening all over the state, including the Eastern Panhandle, where I'm from. And people are talking. Mr. President, somehow we're going to have to move forward and regain that breach of trust.
Unger adds that recently, lack of trust though, is now also causing many West Virginians to begin discussing leaving the state. Tomorrow, Unger says he will introduce a concurrent resolution calling on the President and Congress to take action not just in West Virginia, but the entire country. The resolution will ask the federal government to put more stringent protections in place for the nation's waterways, send more FEMA emergency supplies for distribution, and call on regulatory agencies like the EPA to conduct medical studies on the health effects of the chemicals involved in West Virginia's spill. Unger is asking members of both the House and Senate to back his resolution.
Major issues highlighted during the legislature's interim meetings over the course of the year are starting to come to the forefront in the Senate now that the water protection bill is in the hands of the House. As Astrid Mara reports, that chamber's health committee took action on a bill intended to cut down on meth labs across West Virginia.
Over the past year, West Virginians have had to change the way they buy cold and allergy medicines at their local pharmacy. Instead of picking up what you need in the aisle and paying for it at the register, medicines containing the popular drug pseudoephedrine are now behind the counter, and a pharmacist has to administer the sale. Now, the state legislature is considering changing that practice, making pseudoephedrine a Schedule IV controlled substance, available only through prescription.
The bill updates legislative findings and definitions and sets criminal penalties for persons who purchase, receive, or possess a drug.
Senate Bill 6 is about reducing the number of meth labs in the state. The latest numbers from 2012 show the number of labs increased in West Virginia from 288 to 533. And last year, Kanawha County topped that list with a record 159 labs seized by county and state law enforcement. Proponents of the bill say making pseudoephedrine, the main ingredient in methamphetamine, available only through a prescription will decrease the number of labs and possible exposure to hazardous materials. David Potters is one of those proponents with the West Virginia Board of Pharmacy.
My understanding of the impact in Oregon is that when they went prescription only, their labs went down from double digits, high double digits, and higher down to 10, 11, 12 a year, and has gone down from there. Mississippi was much higher and has gone down 80-some percent down into the 60s and still going down.
If the bill would pass, West Virginia would become only the third state to have a prescription-only law, but it also contains language allowing for what are called tamper-resistant drugs to still be sold over-the-counter, making West Virginia the first to take a position on the medications. According to the bill, the Board of Pharmacy would determine which drugs meet the tamper-resistant standard and are exempt from prescription in consultation with the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration. But there is still strong opposition to the bill by the pharmaceutical industry. Its lobbyists maintain prescription only is not the way to go. Instead, they believe lawmakers should be focused on creating a meth offender registry, like Oklahoma and Kentucky have done, barring the purchase of pseudoephedrine for anyone convicted of a meth-related crime.
But the best way to address this is to address the meth criminal, not the citizen of West Virginia who relies on pseudoephedrine for as a common over-the-counter cold remedy. I have grave reservations of us superseding the DEA's authority on which drugs are safe over-the-counter and non-diversion drugs. The DEA has not given a pass to any pseudoephedrine-containing product. They have not come out as the federal agency regulating those products and said these two products have been given our stamp that they can't be diverted. So I have a huge reservation about the West Virginia Board of Pharmacy having more authority than the federal DEA in this state. I still think the DEA should be the gold standard.
Discussion in the Senate Health Committee also touched on penalties for smurfers, people who buy their limit of pseudoephedrine and sell it to someone else to make meth. After an hour of discussion, though, Committee Chair Ron Stallings says his mind wasn't changed.
I think we can cut down on meth labs and still have access to the medicine when law-abiding citizens need it.
After a voice vote,
all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
The committee did vote to move the bill forward. The vote, however, appeared to be based on party lines, with Senate Republicans voting against it. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Ashton Mara in the Senate.
In a moment, we'll continue to discuss some of the issues around the Elk River chemical spill with the state's attorney general. First, here's a look at some of the bills introduced in the Senate today. Among the bills introduced in the Senate today, Senate Bill 479 to provide veterans with vocational certification or licensure or college credit for military training and experience that is close to what they would gain in the educational setting. Senate Bill 481 to require the Department of Transportation to place signs honoring fallen veterans and Gold Star families within a mile of every Welcome to West Virginia sign along highways entering the state. Senate Bill 482 to establish food handler card requirements. All food handlers would be required to pass an examination from an accredited food safety certification program. Up for passage in the Senate tomorrow, Senate Bill 353 to define timber theft and to provide the Division of Forestry the authority to investigate and enforce violations occurring in state forests managed by the division. Among the bills on second reading, Senate Bill 336 to allow police, fire, and emergency service providers to possess naloxone to administer in suspected narcotic drug overdoses. And Senate Bill 397, expanding the scope of activities considered financial exploitation of the elderly and making the crime a larceny. Just days after the Elk River spill, various agencies announced that there would be thorough investigations into this industrial accident that led to tainted drinking water. They are the U.S. Attorney's Office, the U.S. Chemical Safety Board, the U.S. EPA, and the state DEP, and the Attorney General's Office. Joining us tonight to talk about his investigation is Attorney General Patrick Morrissey. Mr. Morrissey, welcome.
Glad to be back in your program. Thank you.
Tell us about your investigation. Sure. How are you going about it?
Well, we're trying to take a holistic approach. After the water spill began, we realized that we needed to get to the bottom of it. And so what that meant is we needed to figure out exactly what happened, because there's been a lot of speculation, a lot of theories. We want to actually find out exactly what happened. We want to find out why it happened. And then importantly, we want to develop a timeline looking at all the relevant events over the past few years, looking forward to early January up until the present day, and say, what happened and how can we do things even better? And then most importantly, we want to make sure that we're able to provide recommendations as to how we could prevent this from ever happening again. We know that the legislature is considering certain options right now. Some changes are certainly going to be needed, but we want to make sure that we weigh in from a thoughtful perspective and not have the quick rush to judgment, because we want to make sure we get the facts right.
Do you coordinate with all these other agencies that are investigating as well? Do you share information? How does that work?
So in general, we try to coordinate and share information. We have participated in meetings and had a number of discussions with some of the other investigators. So you do want to make sure that you're not stepping all over each other.
Yes.
But obviously, everyone has a different role to play in the process. The role of the Chemical Safety Board is different from the role of the DEP, which is different from the role of the U.S. Attorney's Office, which is different from the role of our office. And so what we're trying to do is figure out a way where we can share information appropriately. And obviously, I think everyone does want to get to the bottom of things.
How long do you think this is going to take?
You know, it's hard to put an exact timeline on it, but I can tell you that we're working very, very hard. We have about 6 people that are focusing extensively on these issues. So I'm hopeful in the upcoming weeks we'll start to have some announcements that we could provide to the public. Mm-hmm. I think it's critical that we assure the public that someone is getting to the bottom of it. And that's certainly what I view my role as. I take that very seriously. I think that the public needs to be reassured.
But that's not to discredit all the other agencies.
No, not at all.
I just want to make that
clear.
No.
To be clear, I think that it's good when there's a lot of sunlight on this process. And I think it's positive that you have the DEP, U.S. Attorney's Office, Chemical Safety Board, and a lot of folks looking at it. That's good for the process.
Did you find actual examples of price gouging during the crisis?
So as you know, one of our other tasks that we're charged with is enforcing our price gouging laws.
Sure.
And so during the water crisis, we did in fact find a number of instances of price gouging. What happened was after the water spill occurred that Thursday, we went out very aggressively talking to people about saying, look, it's against the law to hike up prices more than 10% during a state of emergency. Mm-hmm. We were aggressive Thursday night, Friday, Saturday. We saw the bulk of our calls coming in Friday and Saturday, and then it started to really peter out a little bit. All told, we've probably received about 150 to 180 phone calls. Of those, we had about 80, which were kind of real, and we were able to follow up and investigate. Since then, we've issued 6 subpoenas and then sent out a couple dozen cease and desist letters, and now we're in the process of evaluating the responses to those letters, mm-hmm. reviewing the material that's come back from the subpoenas, so we can decide how to proceed.
Are you still getting calls about, or is it calmed down a little bit?
It's calmed down a lot. We were still getting some isolated calls, but I think for the most part, people know that it's illegal to engage in price gouging during a state of emergency, and I think they know that the AG's office will be enforcing that law vigorously.
You've called on Speaker Miley and the entire legislature to join you to revamp the auditing process.
Absolutely.
Of state agencies, offices, and departments. First of all, the legislative auditor is an office within the legislature.
Right.
It's my understanding that these audits are done on kind of a schedule, a rotating schedule. How do you want to change that?
So I think what we have right now, first of all, we have a good legislative auditor. I think Aaron Allred does a very competent job, and our office has worked with him on a number of different matters. So I think that when you have a good person in place, then you look at different ways that he can make more resources available to audit more. The way that the law operates now, you're only required to do an audit every 2 years if practicable. And what's happened is that the legislative auditor, as good as a job as he's done, he's lacked the resources to do audits more frequently. And that's been a problem for a couple constitutional offices. Specifically, we had the Attorney General's office that only had one audit in a very narrow area a number of years ago and hadn't really had any deep look for decades. That's a real problem. Mm-hmm. You look at the Department of Agriculture, you could go decades without having a real live audit, really to make sure that not only are you looking at the financial performance, but you're doing performance reviews as well. The legislation that I'm backing would call for more frequent auditing. It'll keep the place, you know, if practical, every 2 years, but then it says at a minimum every 4 years, those audits must get done. Mm-hmm. So that's the change. It's designed to be reasonable, but also provide confidence to the public mm-hmm. that we're not going to let the shenanigans of what happened in the AG's office and Department of Ag continue.
Sure. Do you foresee any role the AG's office would have in the legislative audit process?
I do, because that's the way the law currently works. Right now, when the legislative auditor has a finding, he makes publishes his report, and then ultimately the attorney general can take any action as necessary. What we're suggesting here is we keep that function in place, but then we've also offered up, to the extent we can be helpful, we're happy to help the legislative auditor analyze issues and really help him get to the bottom of things.
You sent the letter to Speaker Miley. It just occurred to me. Did you send the letter to Senate President Jeff Kessler?
Well, I've spoken to Senate President Kessler about this as well. I've raised this issue with folks on both the Senate side and on the House side as well. So it's meant to apply to both.
Okay. Can you tell us how he felt about it?
Yeah, I think that Senator Kessler said that he'd look at some of the details, and I know that it was a brief conversation, so I'm going to let Senator Kessler, who I've always worked very effectively with, speak for his own position on the issue. But I have to say, I think it's a no-brainer to be moving forward with more audits. How can anyone think that not auditing a constitutional office for decades is an acceptable practice? I don't think it is. I don't think the public thinks it is as well.
Moving on to one more topic. In the budget that you presented to the Senate Finance Committee, you indicated that you would like to hire an extra attorney to handle civil rights cases. Sure. What kinds of cases?
So right now, the Attorney General's office is charged with enforcing the civil rights and human rights laws in our state. And what happened is last year, there was a new administrative law judge who was appointed to handle those cases. And so what we're trying to do is ensure that we can actually keep up with the pace of cases that are in place. And historically, the office has handled all those functions, and we've never been reimbursed. And so we went to the governor, and we were going to the legislature and say, if you're going to create this new work for us, to have a new judge in place, we need to have another attorney to handle the caseload.
Are there a lot of cases, a big caseload regarding civil rights and human rights in West
Virginia?
Well,
there are always a lot of pending cases. Sometimes you have hundreds of different issues at any one given time. We've been working pretty hard to make progress in reducing the time lag from when a case is filed to when it ultimately is resolved. So we think that an extra attorney will certainly help in that regard.
Think you'll get it?
I'm hopeful. The governor put it in his budget, so we think this is good. I will say that in return, our office is providing $5 million back from our Consumer Protection Fund back to the legislature and to the general treasury. We think that we should always be very diligent with the taxpayers' money.
Is that the settlement money that they were talking about?
That's the settlement money. All right. So that's an important function. So we're just not asking for something. We're trying to return a lot more.
Attorney General Patrick Morrissey, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for letting me on your program.
And here's a look at some of the bills in the House today. Among the bills introduced in the House today, House Bill 4401, to provide for court-appointed special advocate programs in each judicial circuit and court-appointed special advocates in each county for child abuse and neglect cases, and to provide for a revenue stream to fund the programs and hire special advocates. House Bill 4402, to provide a procedure for the conditional discharge for first offense underage purchase, consumption, sale, service, or possession of alcoholic liquor. House Bill 4403, to create a tax credit for certain businesses that locate within a 20-mile radius of a Hatfield-McCoy Recreation Area Trail to spur economic development. House Bill 4406, to create the West Virginia Corporate Political Accountability Act of 2014 relating to a corporation's political activities. The bill requires annual authorization and approval by a majority of shareholders for corporations spending a yearly aggregate of $10,000 or more for political activities in this state. And House Bill 4408, at the request of the West Virginia State Police, relating to the salaries and raises for employees in the forensic laboratory. Among the bills up for passage in the House tomorrow, House Bill 4196, to require the Workforce Investment Council provide information to local workforce investment boards and guidance that would help them better educate both women and men about jobs with high earning potential. House Bill 4236, to establish a statewide system for sexual assault forensic examination services. And House Bill 4284, the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, to provide non-discrimination in the workplace with regard to reasonable accommodations related to pregnancy and childbirth. This has been the Legislature Today.
Today was Kids and Families Day at the legislature. Tomorrow, we'll talk with two children's advocates. We'll talk about the ongoing Our Children, Our Future campaign with Jim McKay, the state director of Prevent Child Abuse West Virginia, and Stephen Smith, the executive director of the West Virginia Healthy Kids and Families Coalition. I'm Beth Voorhees. Thanks for joining us. Good night.